This is Focus 580, hour number two of our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Wincroft, is at the controls. Last month, the Food and Drug Administration released a report concluding that food from healthy cloned animals is as safe to eat as products from conventionally bred animals. In spite of this news, it seems that many consumers continue to be very wary of food from cloned animals and perhaps of the whole idea of cloning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk about animal cloning and food safety, and we have two guests here with us, both of them from the University of Illinois, Bruce Chassie and Matthew Wheeler. Let me tell you a little bit more about them. Bruce Chassie is a professor of food microbiology. He worked as a research chemist for the National Institute of Dental Research, the National Institute of Health, for 21 years before he came to the U of I as head of the Department of Food Science. Following that department's merger with the Division of Foods and Nutrition, he was appointed head of the new Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition and served in that role until May of 2000 when he took up his present position. Matthew Wheeler has conducted more than 25 years of research on things like embryo biology, stem cells, cloning, and transgenic livestock. He's published many papers in peer-reviewed scientific journals, more than 60 book chapters. He's done a lot of speaking at national and international meetings. His responsibilities here at University of Illinois include teaching and research in biotechnology and reproductive biology in the departments of animal sciences, veterinary clinical medicine, and bioengineering. And we're pleased to have both of them here on the program. As we talk, questions are welcome, of course, as always, from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And also, we do have that toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief as possible so we can keep moving along and get in as many different callers as we can. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Well, thank you both very much for being here. We appreciate it. We can understand where we're starting from here. Sort of the reason for doing it, in a sense, was to talk about this announcement that did come out a couple of weeks ago, that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, said upon reviewing all of the research that was available, they said, we have no reason to believe that there's any problems associated with eating meat from a cloned animal, drinking milk from a cloned animal. At least as far as they're concerned, those animals and their products are equal to the meat and the milk that comes from animals that were bred conventionally. Is that pretty much what it is that we're saying?
Yes. Basically, the FDA did a fairly extensive risk assessment, looking at all available studies as well as data that was presented by commercial entities that are involved in this area and any academic researchers that were willing to contribute the raw data. So basically, mm-hmm. this was almost 700 pages in their assessment and the raw data, and that is available on their website.
All right. And just also to get one thing established, and I think it's my understanding, although I want to make sure that we say this right out front, that now, today, there are no food products that come from cloned animals. And we're not going to go down to the grocery store and buy something that has come from a cloned animal. Is that right, or is there some kind of question about that?
Well, I mean, certainly with the FDA's guidance, that is possible. You know, the issue is probably more a practical one, is there just not that many of them out there at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so certainly the voluntary moratorium on sending meat and milk of cloned animals into the food supply has been in effect. But it was a moratorium. It was voluntary. Yeah. And so companies did not necessarily have to follow that. But essentially all of them did. And so there could be meat or milk from
so there could be. So then we really don't know one way or the other.
Well, up until now we have had a moratorium. I think because of this ruling or position that's been taken by the FDA, it is possible. But I have a question for Matt, and that is my impression was that this technology right now is being used as a an animal improvement strategy and a reproductive strategy to produce good or improved breeding stock, and that cloned animals aren't really a product that people are trying to make and put in the market.
That's correct. But in the process of developing the animals, certainly there are a lot of dairy cows that are, you know, females that are lactating that produce milk. And the idea is that some of that milk, now it used to be dumped, you know, potentially get into the food chain. So mm-hmm. so it's a way producers and companies have been holding these animals for a long period of time, and certainly you know, there's an opportunity to now get rid of some of the products, if you will. But Bruce is right. There's no objective to produce cloned meat for the market at the moment.
And I think that it's also my understanding that as far as the U.S. Department of Agriculture is concerned, what they're saying to farmers is that we would rather that you continue to hold back and not release not take a cloned animal and send that to market, at least for the present, don't. They're saying we'd just as soon that you just hold back.
Yeah, you know, USDA, in addition to being a regulatory agency, is also a trade promotion agency. And when they look at markets, they see that we export quite a bit. And of course, we have markets that are sensitive to this kind of thing within the country. And so I think what they're advising farmers is, well, you know, as long as there are consumers here and maybe buyers abroad who aren't certain about this technology, it might be a smarter market strategy not to sell it. Mm-hmm. And so voluntary restraint might be a good market strategy is what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. And again, to make sure that I understand and people who are listening understand the way that the way we think this technology is going to be applied. It is, for example, if you had a dairyman who had a particular cow that was a fantastic milk producer. This just was just the best cow this guy had ever seen in all of his time in being in business. And he would say, you know, I really wish that I had more just like that one. That what this technology would allow you to do is to clone that animal and, in fact, have more cows that were just like that one. So that then you would have, for whatever reason, either that was a particularly great animal, it was a great producer of milk, or to then produce an animal that would then produce more animals, he would say of a particular animal, he'd say, boy, I wish I had more like that one. Well, that's essentially what we're talking about. Is that, reduced to very simple language, is that basically it?
In the best of all cases, the clone is an identical twin of the animal it was cloned from. So if you could clone an animal 100 times, you'd now have 100 more parents for high-quality animals.
Yeah, it's actually like a Xerox machine. It's like exactly what you said. So you take one, and as Bruce said, you make an identical copy or multiple identical copies. But again, you know, just to clarify, so you have a herd of cloned cattle that are from this superior individual that the dairy farmer wanted. It's the milk from those animals that you're going to sell, right? Because the reason that you wanted that 100 more of them is because that cow made a lot of milk, or made calves that you know you could sell that made a lot of milk.
So and to take the same example, say you were raising raising pigs, and you had the same thing. You had a sow that was a male that would just had fantastic qualities. They were great producers of offspring. So there, what you would, again, you might say, I wish that I had more like that, rather than cloning pork chops. What you're not really doing that. What you're doing is you're trying to use this as a way of improving your breeding stock to then produce the animals that then are the ones that are going to go into the
yes.
system.
I mean, that's certainly, you know, the intent right now is to produce those valuable breeding animals that would produce offspring or milk products that are, you know, products that would go in the food chain.
Mm-hmm. Let me throw one other thing on that. The other part of this whole ruling that's kind of interesting to me as someone who doesn't do this kind of research is that the progeny of cloned animals, their offspring, are considered by the FDA as not clones. The first generation is a clone, but its children are not clones. They're considered normally reproduced animals.
Because, in fact, they are just normally reproduced animals.
Yeah, they're correct. Produced by sexual reproduction like any other animal.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the advantage of this technology? What does this enable you to do that you couldn't do by using conventional breeding methods that people who raise animals have been using for a very long time?
Well, I think you hit the example on the head, which is a superior individual, right? I mean, you actually can breed to that superior individual, but when you have normal sexual reproduction, you have random reassortment of the chromosomes, and so essentially the offspring are not may not be as good or better than the parental lines. So if you do have a bull or a cow that has superior traits that you want to propagate and make more individuals for the breeding herd, you know, this is really the only way that you can do it. And we've been using this kind of technology for a number of years. There's the associated technology called embryo transfer, where we take that superior female and we give it super ovulating drugs to cause more ovulations, and then collect the embryos from that individual. And so that way you can put more selection pressure on a female, for example, where a bull might have, 100,000 offspring a year if you used him in artificial insemination. A cow basically only has one offspring. By using embryo transfer, you can push that a little bit and get to, into the hundreds, maybe 100 or 200 offspring. So you can put more selection pressure genetically on the female. Mm-hmm. But with cloning, it's an unlimited. It's like I said, it's essentially a Xerox machine, and you can make as many copies of that individual as you want.
Yeah. One of the problems with this technology is that it doesn't work every time. Out of how many attempts are you going to get a successful result?
Oh, I think the current numbers are, as you say, are very low. I mean, you're talking probably in the 1-5% range. So it's not so you start with 100 cloned embryos and you might get one to five calves born and survive to to adulthood. Mm-hmm. So it's not very efficient. When you look at other reproductive strategies like embryo transfer, I was just talking about, it's about 60%. Even conventional breeding, if you have a 100 animals, and you run a bull with them, you're probably talking in the neighborhood of, high 60s to low 80% conception rates. So even natural reproduction is not perfect.
Mm-hmm. Well, given the fact that it's a technology that its success rate is on the low side, and I'm assuming that also this is something that's expensive to do, why bother? Is it really worth the expense, given how difficult it is and to get a successful outcome?
Depending on the individual that you start with, I mean, if you have a cow that is significantly higher milk production than the average. I mean, your average producer is probably not going to do this. This is technology now for the elite producers. So folks that actually produce cows and bulls that produce the animals that are the foundation for the next generation. So no. But for example, the best example I can give you is, Secretariat. If you could clone Secretariat, you had cells from Secretariat, there was only one. Okay. And you could get an animal like that back. The other thing is, if you have an animal, if you preserve cells and the animal dies, you can bring those genetics back. So there's a rescue opportunity not only for livestock but for endangered species as well. So it's two things: elite breeding animals and preservation. And I'd like to come back to what Bruce talked about for production, because certainly the offspring of clones would be more consistent than the offspring of not clones. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've done over the years is to push our consumers, and the consumers have driven some of this, to you want a pork chop that's a certain size, or you want a steak that's a certain size. And by using technology like this, where the input, which is the animals, are more consistent, the output potentially is more consistent as well. So, and I use the example, if I go to Kansas City or Kiev and I go to McDonald's, a Big Mac's a Big Mac. It's the same thing. And we've gotten used to that. And so if you went into the grocery store and saw a pork chop that was a 2-pound pork chop that was the size of a dinner plate, you probably wouldn't buy it. So the the whole industry has moved toward what does the consumer want, and the consumer drives a lot of this, and the consistency for the packer and for the producer is one of the issues as well.
I have to throw in there, Matt, though, I think there is a substantial segment of consumers, I wouldn't want to put a percentage on it, who deplore that. They actually do want to see pork chops of different sizes and tomatoes of different sizes, and for them, applying technology to food, you know, is not a good thing. So,
one other quick question, then I promise I have a caller here we'll get to. Is there, do you think, some danger in if we do this, the more we do it, what we're doing is we are narrowing the gene pool? And what we are doing is, by that, increasing the possibility that if we have a greater number of animals that are genetically the same, that if we have some kind of problem that is going to affect them, that we're going to have some serious problem, you know, like the equivalent of the potato famine. And we have this kind of concern with other animal and plant species as well, that we're losing biodiversity and that that increases the potential for some kind of problem if we're heavily relying on animals or plants that are genetically all the same.
Well, you know, that's certainly a concern, and that's something you have to be careful of in all kinds of conventional breeding technologies for both plants and animals. But one advantage that this technology does give you is that you can preserve the genetics basically of all animals if you wanted to. So all the members of the Holstein dairy population, you could preserve those and you could keep diversity. So the example that you made is a real one. You know, since 1940, we've decreased the number of dairy cows by half and we've almost tripled their milk production. Okay, but we did that by narrowing the gene pool to highly elite animals that would do this. So you lost all those low-producing cows that may have had some good traits like good feet or legs or reproduction, you know, in the population. So that is an issue that and again, cloning is like making a Xerox copy. You don't get any genetic improvement. You just get more of what you already have.
Well, I have a caller here, and, I kept them waiting too long. My apologies. If they want to call back, they can. Anybody else can call in and talk with our guests, and perhaps I should also introduce them again. Professor Matthew Wheeler here at the U of I. He does teaching and research in biotechnology and reproductive biology in the departments of animal sciences, veterinary clinical medicine, and bioengineering. And also with us is Bruce Chassie. He's professor of food microbiology. Up until 2000, he also was the head of the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition here at the University of Illinois. Questions are welcome. We're talking about cloning and its impact on the food that we eat. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455.
David, let me pick up on that last point Matt was making. You know, sometimes I hear people saying that we shouldn't breed plants or animals because we'll lose genetic diversity. And at the same time, of course, we're being asked for nutritional improvements, you know, quality improvements, and breeding is the only way to get at them. But I think it's important to recognize that the people who breed plants and animals are aware of this issue and they understand the consequences of loss of genetic diversity. And as Matt says, are trying to build genetic diversity banks and preserve species because it's a very real issue. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it and you shouldn't have improvement. It means you need to be mindful of it and not walk down the primrose path to such a genetically restricted animal that it's no longer viable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with Bruce. It is a big issue, and the breeders know that. I was involved in an effort, a national effort, to preserve germplasm from livestock species a few years ago. And one of the issues was in the dairy cattle breed, we were looking for 100 unrelated bulls, basically for species diversity, and we couldn't find them. Because basically what producers had done is they bred to the best bulls, which were related to single individuals that had some superior trait. And now, you know, we've narrowed the pool. So again, we have to be careful not only from livestock perspective, but, you know, a general animal diversity perspective.
Yeah. Interesting example you gave earlier about the fact that, say, if you could clone Secretariat, you might be able to end up with an animal that performed as well. Now, certainly, we know that with breeding today, you know, you could take two fabulous horses and mate them, and the offspring, you know, they could be a dud. There's no guarantee what they're going to be like. So then you'd say, well, okay, so if I can have an exact copy of Secretariat, well, then I'd have Secretariat again. But I imagine that some people who breed and race horses, they might say, well, you know, there's no guarantee that you're going to actually get the Secretariat again, even if you have a horse that's the genetic, that's like a Xerox copy of Secretariat. Now, so then that maybe it's a different thing if we're talking about dairy cows, but is it really that reliable that you're going to get an animal that truly, in all respects, and maybe at least in the important ones that you're looking at, that is, you know, the health and productivity of the animal, that's really going to be exactly the same?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, that's a good point. You know, what we teach our students is it's 10% genetics and 90% environment. And so depending on the environment, you're exactly right. And if I produced a clone of a cow that I had in my herd, you know, with some physiological variation and nutrition and management, certainly, you know, my expectation would be that they would produce, you know, pretty close. Now, in another herd, maybe not. But
a great movie was The Boys from Brazil, which if any of the listeners haven't seen it, I highly recommend. They probably still have the DVD or videotape out in the rental stores, which really makes the point that there is a tremendous impact of nurture in addition to the nature or genetics of the beast. So you can take a clone and feed it differently, raise it differently, and come up with a very different performing animal.
So though if you then could, to the extent that you can, you took the clone and you raised it in the same way, you fed it the same, you treated it the same, you should get an animal that's going to be very close, very, very close to to what was, I don't know if you call it the parent or what, you know, what do you call the person that, the individual that supplied the
we just call it the donor.
The donor. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Secretariat is, you know, it has name recognition. So that's why I bring that up. And again, it's really apples and oranges because in that case, it's performance. It's athletic performance versus something that's like growth or lactation, which is, you know, pretty rooted in the management as well as the genetics. So they are really different things.
All right. Let's talk with some callers here. We have a caller to start us in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I think the public feels uneasy about maybe part of the source was when it came to genetically modified foods, especially it seems, and from my understanding, part of it is that it was modified so it could take more pesticides, you know, that kind of thing. The other issue is that, from my understanding, you know, not that much knowledge of the, you know, genetics, is that we don't fully understand it yet. I mean, there can be some defective things in there that are not discovered until later. Is that true or not?
Yeah. What about that?
I just wanted to respond about the genetically modified foods. We modify genetically modified foods, at least certain crops, so that we use less pesticides or even no pesticides. I'm also a little leery when people start talking about what consumers' concerns are. I think the caller is correct that there are some consumer concerns out there, but we don't really know exactly why they are or what they are. What we do know, and the FDA addressed this actually in their conclusions, was that consumers know very little about this particular topic. They're not sure that most consumers understand what a clone is. I think the caller might be correct that they are confusing it with genetically modified foods about which they may have different concerns. But there really isn't good quantitative or qualitative data about what consumers feel. In fact, given a little information, at least in one survey, consumers seemed not to be very concerned about cloned animals in the one study that was done. My view of this is that this has been hyped in the media. The FDA report was picked up and it was put in the media. And it's the media that made the concern rather than consumers, because consumers really were pretty, I would say, uninformed, unaware of this whole issue until it hit CNN and Fox News and all the rest of them.
Well, the public is pretty not informed when it comes to politics either. So, I mean, you know.
You got that.
Okay.
All right. Well, just I think what the caller points at, the concern that some people have about genetically modified food crops. For example, you know, you can create a soybean plant that's impervious to herbicide. So you can spray your whole field with weed killer. It'll kill all the weeds, and the soybeans will be just fine. The concern, I think, that some people had about that plant was that here we had created something that did not exist before. It was a novel plant. It was something new. Didn't exist in nature.
David, we've been making herbicide-resistant crops using traditional genetic approaches for quite some time, and those kinds of crops are on the market. And we've been using herbicides for quite some time on soybeans. The numbers are that when you make that herbicide-resistant soybean, you probably use less total herbicide than you would if you didn't have that herbicide-resistant soybean. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. But I think the caller is correct in saying that some of people's concerns about genetically modified foods are getting sort of dumped over onto the clones, yeah. And the clones are a very different issue.
Well, that's the point I was I was going for, and that is, you know, I'm not sure I exactly want to get into arguing about GM food crops, but one of the concerns that people have it does go to this issue of, well, have we created a plant that has not existed in nature before, and is that going to create some difficulty when we introduce it into the environment? When we're talking about cloning, this is a whole different thing, because if indeed the cloned individual is the same as the donor, then it's not like we're creating something that didn't exist before. Yeah. We're making a copy of something that did exist before. So there, people may well have concerns about cloning, but one ought to at least separate out those two.
Right, and I think in the cloning area, many of the concerns which I think you've identified are not about the science, because you're trying to make a Xerox copy. There are some, but there are these other concerns, and they're clearly ethical concerns about cloning and market concerns and things like that. Yeah. And those loom larger, I think.
Let me just, again, real quick, and I promise we've got callers and get back to another question that the caller raised, because this is one of the concerns that has been raised in connection with the cloned animals, and that is the idea that if you're taking your donor, as far as you know, is a completely healthy animal. You can't find any problems with this animal. The concern is that there might be something lurking there, some problem that might not be immediately apparent, that then when you make the clones will maybe later emerge in the cloned animals. How possible is something like that?
Well, I think if you look at the genomes of animals and even humans, there are endogenous sequences that are viral-like that if they're activated could cause a problem, right? We know them as oncogenes, for example. So, you know, the issue is there whether you use conventional reproduction, whether you use cloning, or you do transgenics, where you'd put in a gene and maybe activate it directly. You probably have a better chance with a clone of not having that happen, because you've already had that animal pretty much go through a whole cycle. So, mm-hmm. So going through the embryonic development and expression of those genes, what gets turned on and what gets turned off is pretty much, in many cases it happens at random. So you don't know. The frequency probably is less than conventional reproduction, where it could happen when you reunited genomes that are dissimilar.
Mm-hmm. Standard sexual reproduction has got to be risky business. You know, we don't often think about it, but we take two genomes and recombine the DNA from those two genomes into a whole new set of chromosomes when we make a new individual, and hope that
it works.
Yeah,
you know, and this is a very sensitive, you know, process, and so that's why the cloning is not very efficient, because any small changes, anything that you do to those embryos, you know, basically result in embryo lethality. So if there's something seriously wrong, you know, Mother Nature takes care of it in utero before the animal is born.
Do you expect that over time, as we get more and more experience doing this, that your success rate is going to go up?
I think with experience, it does go up. But, you know, will it ever advance conventional reproduction? Probably not.
Okay. Let's talk with someone in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Thing that occurs to me, some time ago I saw in one of the nature programs that the African, the cat that runs real fast, I'm trying to think of its name.
Cheetah.
Cheetah.
What'd you say, sir?
Cheetah.
The cheetah, yes. That they were down to a few pairs.
Correct.
And what are the ramifications of that? When you have a few pairs, and they are the sum total of the existence, everything behind them, I'm sure I'm wrong in this, everything behind them, does it appear in the living?
So I think there are two problems here, and I'll let Matt talk about it, but, you know, from a layman scientist point of view, obviously when you get down to a few pairs, you have very little genetic diversity in the population, and that can lead to problems that Matt will describe. But you also have the bigger problem of what's leading to the very few number of animals, and very often it's related to the way they reproduce and the large domain that the predator requires. But when you boil it all down, human activity has had an impact on their habitat. You have habitat loss. And until you solve that problem, then how much genetic diversity you have left is the lesser problem.
Well, that's what I'm driving at, because now we have a huge surplus of human beings. And with the ideas of feeding them with milk and meat and all the other things that we're all on the same road. Either we're heading to a future or we're heading to destruction. And it's now occurs to me that there's going to be, it's going to be either or. And if we modify the world that we live in to a point that it becomes unlivable, I mean, do those things actually occur to the scientists who are in these fields? I want to ring off with this. I saw the 60 Minutes, and this handsome doctor had donated sperm to this woman, and she had the baby. And she, I still laugh about it, that it was the doctor's brain. The brain. Did you think she's going to get a duplicate of that guy's brain? Was a combination of her own? And then how well fed we are? There's some smaller humans, I think, in this world, in the third world, who don't get enough to eat, who are reduced in size, and all the other things that go along with good nutrition. Well, thanks, David, and I'll ring off.
Okay. Well, that indeed gets back to some of the points that we made about, first of all, conventional reproduction. There's no guarantee, and you cannot forget the influence of the environment in which the individual, right, whatever you're talking about an animal, you're talking about a human being, that's going to determine what kind of result you get.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, to the caller's point with regard to the cheetah, the gene pool is very narrow. And so, you know, now is the time to start, you know, preserving those genetics if we ever hope to save the habitat and reintroduce those animals. You know, all is not lost. I mean, even with two individuals, there's enough diversity in the genome, you know, to bring back a species. But, you know, the point, I think, is that as we go down this road, you're going to be preserving genetics and not narrowing the gene pool. And scientists do think about this a lot. And many of my colleagues, you know, their focus is on endangered species and not necessarily on production agriculture, because now there's a tool to preserve animals that otherwise would no longer exist.
Let me second that. I think scientists certainly do think about these things a lot. They're aware of them. They're maybe not as politically active as they ought to be, and we're really glad to be on a show like this so that we can highlight some of these issues.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Bruce Chassy. He's the last person you heard speak. He's a professor of food microbiology here at the University of Illinois. Until 2000, he was head of the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. And he is here with us this morning, and also is with us is Professor Matthew Wheeler. And his responsibilities here include teaching and research in biotechnology and reproductive biology in the departments of animal sciences, veterinary clinical medicine, and bioengineering. And he's done research in things like embryo biology, stem cells, cloning, transgenic livestock. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let us say that I was a farmer and I had a dairy herd and I had a cow that I wanted to clone, what would it cost me?
I think that's a good question. You know, now with the FDA's, you know, ruling, I think they're, you know, the price is going to come down because more people are going to do it. But I mean, it's in the, you know, depending on the species you're talking about, you're probably talking in the, you know, high tens to maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, depending on what you're talking about.
Yeah. So it was stiff. It's the kind of thing that a lot of producers are not going to be able to afford. They couldn't even think about it.
Correct.
Yeah. But there's a flip side to that. I was at a reception in our embassy in Moscow that the USDA was holding, and they brought in a lot of different Russian agricultural producers to this reception. And I had a Russian animal breeder who runs a big commercial breeding operation ask me about whether we in the U.S. could solve this problem they had. They figured they needed between 100,000 and 500,000 dairy calves a year to start new dairies in the former Soviet Union. And he said, you know, the world market for dairy calves just isn't that big, and you guys have the technology to clone these things in an economical way, because there's no other way we're going to get 500,000 dairy calves.
Right. You know, and I think when you ask the question about the price, you know, the equivalent question is, what does an elite dairy bull that going into the bull stud cost? And they're in the hundreds of thousands of dollars as well, you know, so it's really not any different. So what you're doing is you're talking about paying for a process that basically you're purchasing an individual that you know the genetics of and how it's going to perform. The other case is it's expensive, because to get to the point where you know it's a you know, $100,000 bull, it takes, you know, 5, 6, 7 years to get to that point. Well, then the bull is 5, 6, or 7 years old. And now you know what you have. And that's really where cloning comes in, is now that you know what you have, you actually can produce more of them. You know, a really good example in you know, pig breeding is, you know, you know what your best market animals are after they're castrated and when they're on the slaughter floor. Well, they're not only not reproductively sound, they're no longer with you. And so here you have an opportunity to basically take those animals, which would have been your superior breeding animals had you known 6 months ago what they were going to be like, and you can actually bring boars back. And those boars or bulls that end up in studs basically will impact the producer, because the producer will have access to buying those genetics. So it's not very far removed from the producer, although not many producers are probably going to do that with their animals.
Yeah. Just again, what we're talking about here is a technology that would be used to produce superior breeding animals, and then they would breed conventionally, and then the animals that would go to market would be they're not clones. Maybe their parents were clones, but they're not clones.
Right.
And then I think at one point, maybe it was before we got started here, I said something, made this kind of offhand comment about, well, we're never going to have cloned pork chops. And then Matt Wheeler said, well, maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, you would never see a day where we would have substantial numbers of – you'd go to the grocery store, and in the meat case, you would see substantial numbers of meat products there that would have been from cloned animals.
Okay, so in your example, you know, what happens if by natural selection we produce a pig that is has natural high omega-3 fatty acids? It's a healthy pig. Yeah. It's a pork chop that is not only the other white meat, it's the better white meat. Okay, and you have this individual. Well, you could potentially clone this individual and make a boar, and then go through all that process and make a herd, which would take you years to do. Okay. And so what we're basically talking about is time here. How long do you want it to happen? So if we took a clone bull and we expected for his offspring to have penetration into the genetics of the Holstein breed, for example, that one bull would take 35 years. Okay. So do you wait 35 years or do you go to the clones when you can have it next year? So I say, I think those are, you know, those are questions, and those are, you know, maybe a little bit out there examples, but, you know, because of the inefficiencies and the expense, you're probably correct. But I don't want to say no, never, because, you know, there may be opportunities that present themselves that where you'd want to do that.
Yeah. Isn't there a very small market where the scientists like yourself who are producing these animals end up with cloned animals that reach maturity, and you have a disposal issue, and the question is, can these animals be considered regular meat animals and be sent to market, or do you have to dispose of them in an incinerator like you do now? And doesn't the FDA ruling allow you to put those animals in the market?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So we talked about those 100 cows we're going to make from that one, yeah, the dairy farmer. At some point, that dairy farmer wants to get rid of those 100 cows besides the milk and their offspring. You know, how do they do that? And so at some point, you know, I think you are going to see that.
Yeah. But it's it would only be a small percentage of that. And I suppose there again, what would maybe concern some people would be that that would be in there in the meat case, and you wouldn't know, you know, if you were looking at two pork chops or you're looking at 2 pounds of ground beef, you would have no, as a consumer, you would have no way of knowing which was which.
And neither would a scientist, because the composition of those things is absolutely indistinguishable from one another. There is no biological, physiological, or chemical difference between them.
Let's talk with another caller here in Savoy. This is Lion One. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yes, I wanted to ask a question as it regards to biodiversity. I know you said that you could, and I didn't know this, it's very interesting, that you could take two animals and in theory you could create and generate more of their kind out of just two animals, a male and a female. So if you were doing that, and this is really pretty much looking ahead to the future, I don't think it's right now, but if you did that and you created a whole new pet, say, of a group of cheetahs by cloning the one pair, aren't you eliminating biodiversity, which makes them more vulnerable to, say, a new virus or bacteria that might mutate and spring out and wipe them out, or any other animal, including a human, if we're over-cloned? And I'll just listen to the answer that you give, and I'll hang up.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I think the point's clear. Okay.
No, I think the caller, you know, is exactly correct. My point was that you can bring back a species with two individuals. It's not the best scenario, but you know the alternative is to lose the species. And so certainly, you know, with conventional genetics, there is diversity there, and you'd have to be very careful that on the individuals that you pick to mate from that original pair, so that you got as much diversity as you possibly can. But the caller is exactly correct that you do set them up for you know, potential problems. And you know, my point with regard to cloning was, by having a bank of cells and preserving the genetics of the population when it's a large population as opposed to a population of two, we might be better off.
Yeah. So depending upon the animal and the environment it lives in, you certainly want to have far more individuals than just a pair to maintain genetic diversity. But if you're down to the last representative of a species, let's just say the last cheetah, you certainly would want to clone and bank the cells and the DNA and to find a surrogate cat mother to have little cheetahs, because it would be the only, you know, it'd be the last chance. One thing I want to throw into this, though, is that sometimes when we have these conversations, we get caught in what I consider the sort of museum view of the genetics of animals. That is, a cow is a cow, a pig is a pig, a cheetah is a cheetah. And it kind of overlooks the fact that our genetics are fluid. We're constantly changing. New mutations, new traits are constantly appearing. And at least theoretically possible that if you had one breeding pair of some animal and you were able to protect them and let them breed for long enough, and this is an evolutionary process, you would literally recreate diversity within that breeding population. So we're not in a static place. So there is some long-term hope.
Yeah. Well, just I want to, though, go back to another point that I think that Matthew Wheeler made, and I think that it's important to keep in mind for those people who are concerned about the potential, again, of cloning when it comes to domestic animals that are raised for meat or for food. This concern that if we do a lot of this cloning, that we're going to reduce biodiversity, I think it's important to keep in mind, as you said, that by conventional breeding, we've already done this. So that it's something that right now today should be a concern.
Yes, and the reason we did it by conventional breeding is you can't afford to keep all these animals around. I mean, the producers, you know, objective was to make more milk and make more meat to feed people. I mean, that was their objective. And so, you know, keeping low producing dairy animals around for the potential future use was really not, you know, even in the cards at that point.
Right. And I think the bigger picture view of it is that there's nothing natural about agriculture and genetics anyway. But the animals that we grow and the plants that we grow don't exist in nature for the most part. And we started a long time ago restricting their genetic diversity, and we're sort of narrowing it down and narrowing it down to the few plants we want to grow and the few animals we want to breed. And it's part of a long process. Is it the smartest thing to do from a biology point of view? Maybe not, but we get a lot of food out of it.
Well, from the – let me just ask you, you know, flat out. You know, from the – what we have said, what we started out by saying that the FDA looked at the studies of cloned animals and said that as far as all of these studies to date indicate – that is meat from cloned animals, milk from cloned animals, it's safe to eat the meat and drink the milk, and that in fact what we're saying is that we don't see any difference between the two products, between the products, between the pork chop from the conventionally bred pig and the pork chop from the cloned pig. So what you would say as far as you're concerned and as far as we know right today, you don't have any concerns about the safety of those food products for human consumption?
Me personally, none whatever. I'd much rather have the FDA focus their attention on foodborne pathogens, on some of the, you know, imported foods that people are concerned about that, that aren't produced according to our standards, and a whole host of other issues that are better uses of the FDA's, you know, budget.
Yeah, and I don't have any concerns either. I mean, I've looked at – I've essentially looked at all the data that the FDA has. And I have no concerns at this point.
So do you – getting back to the issue of what people's concerns are, do you in fact think – I think you pretty much said as much – that if people are worried, it's because either in the media hasn't done a very good job of explaining what this is about, or that scientists maybe who work in this area who haven't done a very good job – that is, in people are scared – and the reason that they're scared is that they don't really understand what it is that we're talking about, and that you would say if they really did understand it, they wouldn't be scared. They probably found something else to be scared about.
Yeah, I think, you know, as the previous caller pointed out, there's probably spillover from other issues like the genetic modified foods. There's not a lot of basic understanding of what this is. I do think, honestly, in this case that the media tried – or at least some media outlets tried to hype it, but it, and make it into a scary thing because it's kind of tabloid journalism. And if you look at the way they do that, is they always get a scientist or an FDA representative and then someone who is opposed to it, who has a concern with it. And it was really strange in this particular case, the Center for Science and the Public Interest, who constantly criticizes FDA, we call them the food police sometimes, they really do a good scientific job of staying on FDA's case. They said they had no problem with these cloned animals. So CNN, at least I was watching, used somebody from the Center for Food Safety, which is a non-governmental NGO. It's got a staff of about 5 people, and none of them are scientists. They're lawyers. They were the people that came out and talked about all the horrors and, you know, how unsafe this would be and everything else. And that just says to me as a watcher that they're trying to make an issue to excite the viewing public. And you can always find someone to speak out. And when there's not a high level of understanding, I think it's pretty natural to be scared. Most of us don't like somebody messing around with our food. And if we don't understand what they're doing, I think it's pretty natural to say, hey, don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with somebody else here in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I'm losing my voice. A moment ago, you had a caller who was asking about biodiversity. And if I just want to make sure I understood you correctly, that if you had just the two animals, that if you allowed them to breed, there would, again, eventually be biodiversity. Could I shorten that to say that within the two animals' DNA, or their genes, I'm not sure how to say that, they have all of the past in them? That's about the best I can ask the question. Hang up and listen.
I'm not sure you can say that you have all of the past. Certainly you have a significant amount of the past. And I think, you know, the point that Bruce was trying to make is that, and I was trying to make as well, is that the DNA, biodiversity is generated. So with each new generation, you have some mutations that are positive or negative. Okay. And as you go through the process, potentially you generate more diversity given enough time and that there aren't lethal things that happen to the individuals. But
and let me add to that. Any given individual is sort of a genetic bottleneck. It is a lot of things from the past that have been discarded, and it's kind of what's been distilled out of the past. But it's DNA is still made up of A's, T's, C's, and G's, and those mutate and they change. And given long enough time, it has the potential to make any gene or any trait out to reinvent it or recreate it. So it's fully potent to have complete biodiversity. Of course, you know, evolution's been going on this planet for a long time, and it's pretty tough to predict how long it would take to turn a cow into a pig, for example.
Well, but the key, I think probably the key point here when you're talking about the two individuals breeding and eventually bringing back the kind of diversity that you could have with larger population. You indeed are talking about something that would take a long time. You're talking many, many, many generations.
Millennia.
Yeah.
But you're talking thousands, potentially thousands of years.
Point, having zero cheetahs means you're finished. Yeah. Having one cheetah means you have a chance, if you can protect it, to let it have those thousands of generations and reestablish itself. So all we're saying is that it's capable of doing that.
Right.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a couple of callers that we can't take. If people are interested in more on this, certainly they can go to the website of the food and the FDA, FDA.gov,
yep.
And they can read this report that we're
right. If you go
about.
To www.fda.gov and do a search for cloned animals or look in the upper right-hand corner of the webpage right now, they have a hot topic on cloned animals. Yeah. You can get it.
All right. Our guest's Bruce Jassy. He's professor of food microbiology here at the U of I and Professor Matt Wheeler. He does research in biotech and reproductive biology in the departments of animal sciences, vet, clinical medicine, and bioengineering. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.